Chapter 14. The Earlier Crime.
Why? Why?
Twistle looked helplessly from the gauge to the technician, his eyes mirroring the puzzled frustration in his voice. Harlan lifted his head. He had only one word to say.
Noyes.
Twistle said,
"The woman you took into eternity?"
Harlan smiled bitterly, said nothing. Twistle said,
"What has she to do with this great time? I don't understand, boy."
"What is there to understand?"
Harlan burned with sorrow.
"Why do you pretend ignorance?
I had a woman. I was happy, and so was she. We harmed no one. She did not exist in the new reality. What difference would it have made to anyone?" Twistle tried vainly to interrupt. Harlan shouted,
"But there are rules in eternity, aren't there? I know them all. Liaisons require permission. Liaisons require computations. Liaisons require status. Liaisons are tricky things. What were you planning for Noyes when all this was over? A seat in a crashing rocket? Or a more comfortable position as community mistress for worthy computers? You won't make any plans now, I think."
He ended in a kind of despair, and Twistle moved quickly to the communiplate. Its function as a transmitter had obviously been restored. The computer shouted into it till he aroused an answer. Then he said,
"This is Twistle. No one is to be allowed in here. No one, no one. Do you understand? Then see to it. It goes for members of the All-When Council. It goes for them particularly."
He turned back to Harlan, saying abstractedly,
"They'll do it because I'm old and senior member of the council, and because they think I'm cranky and queer. They give in to me because I'm cranky and queer."
For a moment, he fell into a ruminative silence. Then he said,
"Do you think I'm queer?"
And his face turned swiftly up to Harlan's like that of a seamed monkey. Harlan thought,
"Great time, the man's mad.
The shock has driven him mad." He took a step backward, automatically aghast at being trapped with a madman. Then he steadied. The man, be he ever so mad, was feeble, and even madness would end soon. Soon? Why not at once? What delayed the end of eternity? Twistle said, he had no cigarette in his fingers, his hand made no move to take one, in a quiet, insinuating voice,
"You haven't answered me. Do you think I'm queer?"
"I suppose you do.
Too queer to talk to. If you had thought of me as a friend instead of as a crotchety old man, whimsical and unpredictable, you would have spoken openly to me of your doubts. You would have taken no such action as you did."
Harlan frowned. The man thought Harlan was mad, that was it. He said angrily,
"My action was the right one, I'm quite sane."
Twistle said,
"I told you the girl was in no danger, you know."
"I was a fool to believe that even for a while. I was a fool to believe the council would be just to a technician."
"Who told you the council knew any of this?"
"Finge knew of it, and sent in a report concerning it to the council."
"And how do you know that?"
"I got it out of Finge at the point of a neuronic whip. The business end of a whip abolishes comparative status."
"The same whip that did this?"
Twistle pointed to the gauge with its blob of molten metal perched, wryly, above the face of the dial.
"Yes."
"A busy whip."
Then sharply,
"Do you know why Finge took it to the council instead of handling the matter himself?" "Because he hated me, and wanted to make certain I lost all status. He wanted Noyes."
Twistle said,
"You're naive. If he had wanted the girl, he could easily have arranged liaison. A technician would not have been in the way." "The man hated me, boy."
Still no cigarette. He looked odd without one, and the stained finger he laid on his chest as he spoke the last pronoun looked almost indecently bare.
"You? There's such a thing, boy, as council politics. Not every computer is appointed to the council. Finge wanted an appointment. Finge is ambitious and wanted it badly. I blocked it because I thought him emotionally unstable. Time. I never fully appreciated how right I was. Look, boy. He knew you were a protege of mine. He had seen me take you out of a job as an observer and make you a master technician. He saw you working for me steadily. How better could he get back at me and destroy my influence? If he could prove my pet technician guilty of a terrible crime against eternity, it would reflect on me. It might force my resignation from the Orwen Council, and who do you suppose would then be a logical successor? His empty hands moved to his lips, and when nothing happened, he looked at the space between finger and thumb blankly. Harlan thought, he's not as calm as he's trying to sound. He can't be. But why does he talk all this nonsense now, with eternity ending? Then, in agony, but why doesn't it end then, now? Twistle said, when I allowed you to go to Finge just recently, I more than half suspected danger. But Melanson's memoir said you were away the last month, and no other natural reason for your absence offered itself. Fortunately, Finge underplayed his hand. In what way? Asked Harlan wearily. He didn't really care, but Twistle talked and talked, and it was easier to take part than to try to shut the sound out of his ears. Twistle said, Finge labeled his report, unprofessional conduct of technician Andrew Harlan. He was being the faithful eternal, you see, being cool, impartial, unexcited. He was leaving it to the council to rage and throw itself at me. Unfortunately for himself, he did not know of your real importance. He did not realize that any report concerning you would be instantly referred to me unless its supreme importance were made perfectly clear on the very face of things. You never spoke to me of this. How could I? I was afraid to do anything that would disturb you with the crisis of the project at hand. I gave you every opportunity to bring your problem to me. Every opportunity? Harlan's mouth twisted in disbelief, but then he thought of Twistle's weary face on the communiplate, asking him if he had nothing to say to him. That was yesterday. Only yesterday. Harlan shook his head but turned his face away now. Twistle said softly, I realized at once that he had deliberately goaded you into your rash action. Harlan looked up. You know that? Does that surprise you? I knew Finge was after my neck. I've known it for a long time. I'm an old man, boy. I know these things. But there are ways in which doubtful computers can be checked upon. There are some protective devices, culled out of time, that are not placed in the museums. There are some that are known to the council alone. Harlan thought bitterly of the time block at the 100,000th. From the report, and from what I knew independently, it was easy to deduce what must have happened. Harlan asked suddenly, I suppose Finge suspected you of spying? He might have. I wouldn't be surprised. Harlan thought back to his first days with Finge, when Twistle first showed his abnormal interest in the young observer. Finge had known nothing of the Melanson project, and he had been interested in Twistle's interference.
Have you ever met Senior Computer Twistle?
He had once asked, and thinking back, Harlan could recall the exact tone of sharp uneasiness in the man's voice. As early as that, Finge must have suspected Harlan of being Twistle's finger man. His enmity and hate must have begun that early. Twistle was speaking.
So if you had come to me...
Come to you? Cried Harlan. What of the council?
Of the entire council, only I know.
You never told them?
Harlan tried to be mocking.
I never did.
Harlan felt feverish. His clothes were choking him. Was this nightmare to go on forever? Foolish, irrelevant chatter. For what? Why? Why didn't eternity end? Why didn't the clean peace of non-reality reach out for them?
Great time, what was wrong?
Twistle said, Don't you believe me?
Harlan shouted,
Why should I? They came to look at me, didn't they? At that breakfast? Why should they have done that if they didn't know of the report? They came to look at the queer phenomenon who had broken the laws of eternity, but who couldn't be touched for one more day. One more day, and then the project would be over. They came to gloat for the tomorrow they were expecting.
My boy, there was nothing of that. They wanted to see you only because they were human. Councilmen are human, too. They could not witness the final kettle drive because the Melanson memoir did not place them at the scene. They could not interview Cooper, since the memoir made no mention of that either. Yet they wanted something. Father Time, boy, don't you see? They would want something. You were as close as they could get, so they brought you close and stared at you.
I don't believe you.
It's the truth.
Harlan said, is it? And while we ate, Councilman Senor talked of a man meeting himself he obviously knew about my illegal trips into the 482nd, and my nearly meeting myself. It was his way of poking fun at me, enjoying himself, cutely, at my expense. Twistle said,
Senor? You worried about Senor? Do you know the pathetic figure he is? His home when is the 803rd? One of the few cultures in which the human body is deliberately disfigured to meet the aesthetic requirements of the time. It is rendered hairless at adolescence. Do you know what that means in the continuity of man? Surely you do. A disfigurement sets men apart from their ancestors and descendants. Men of the 803rd are poor risks as eternals. They are too different from the rest of us. Few are chosen. Senor is the only one of his century ever to sit on the council. Don't you see how that affects him? Surely you understand what insecurity means. Did it ever occur to you that a councilman could be insecure? Senor has to listen to discussions involving the eradication of his reality for the very characteristic that makes him so conspicuous among us. And eradicating it would leave him one of a very few in all the generation to be disfigured as he is. Someday it will happen. He finds refuge in philosophy. He overcompensates by taking the lead in conversation, by deliberately airing unpopular or unaccepted viewpoints. His man-meeting-himself paradox is a case in point. I told you that he used it to predict disaster for the project, and it was we, the councilmen, that he was attempting to annoy, not you. It had nothing to do with you. Nothing.
Twistle had grown heated. In the long emotion of his words, he seemed to forget where he was and the crisis that faced them. For he slipped back into the quick-gestured, uneasily motioned gnome that Harlan knew so well. He even slipped a cigarette from his sleeve pouch and had all but frictioned it into combustion. But then he stopped, wheeled, and looked at Harlan again, reaching back through all his own words to what Harlan had last said, as though until that moment he had not heard them properly. He said,
"What do you mean you almost met yourself?"
Harlan told him briefly and went on,
"You didn't know that?"
"No."
There were a few moments of silence that were as welcome to the feverish Harlan as water would have been. Twistle said,
"Is that it? What if you had met yourself?"
"I didn't."
Twistle ignored that.
"There is always room for random variation. With an infinite number of realities, there can be no such thing as determinism. Suppose that in the Melanson reality, in the previous turn of the cycle..."
"The circle goes on forever?" asked Harlan, with what wonder he could still find in himself.
"Do you think only twice? Do you think two is a magic number? It's a matter of infinite turns of the circle in finite physiotime. Just as you can draw a pencil round and round the circumference of a circle infinitely, yet enclose a finite area. In previous turns of the cycle you had not met yourself. This one time, the statistical uncertainty of things made it possible for you to meet yourself. Reality had to change to prevent the meeting, and in the new reality, you did not send Cooper back to the 24th, but..."
Harlan cried, "What's all this talk about? What are you getting at? It's all done. Everything. Let me alone now. Let me alone!"
"I want you to know you've done wrong. I want you to realize you did the wrong thing."
"I didn't. And even if I did, it's done.
But it is not done. Listen just a little while longer.
Twistle was wheedling, almost crooning with an agonized gentleness.
You will have your girl. I promised that. I still promise it. She will not be harmed. You will not be harmed, I promise you this. It is my personal guarantee.
Harlan stared at him wide-eyed.
But it's too late. What's the use?
It is not too late. Things are not irreparable. With your help, we can succeed yet. I must have your help. You must realize that you did wrong. I am trying to explain this to you. You must want to undo what you have done.
Harlan licked his dry lips with a dry tongue and thought,
he is mad. His mind can't accept the truth, or does the council know more?
Did it? Did it? Could it reverse the verdict of the changes? Could they halt time or reverse it? He said,
you locked me in the control room, kept me helpless, you thought, till it was all over.
You said you were afraid something might go wrong with you, that you might not be able to carry on with your part.
That was meant to be a threat.
I took it literally. Forgive me. I must have your help.
It came to that. Harlan's help must be had.
Was he mad? Was Harlan mad?
Did madness have meaning or anything at all, for that matter?
The council needed his help. For that help, they would promise him anything.
Noyes,
computership. What would they not promise him? And when his help was done with, what would he get? He would not be fooled a second time.
No,
he said.
You will have Noyes.
You mean the council will be willing to break the laws of eternity once the danger is safely gone? I don't believe it.
How could the danger safely be passed? A sane scrap of his mind demanded.
What was this all about? The council will never know.
Would you be willing to break the laws? You're the ideal, eternal. With the danger gone, you would obey the law. You couldn't act otherwise.
Twistle reddened, blotchily, high on each cheekbone. From the old face, all shrewdness and strength drained away. There was left only a strange sorrow.
I will keep my word to you and break the law, said Twistle, for a reason you don't imagine. I don't know how much time is left us before eternity disappears. It could be hours, it could be months, but I have spent so much time in the hope of bringing you to reason that I will spend a little more. Will you listen to me, please?
Harlan hesitated. Then, out of a conviction of the uselessness of all things, as much as out of anything else, said wearily,
go on. I have heard,
began Twistle,
that I was born old, that I cut my teeth on a microcomputerplex, that I keep my hand computer in a special pocket of my pajamas when I sleep, that my brain is made up of little force relays in endless parallel hookups, and that each corpuscle of my blood is a microscopic spatio-temporal chart floating in computer oil. All these stories come to me eventually, and I think I must be a little proud of them. Maybe I go around believing them a bit. It's a foolish thing for an old man to do, but it makes life a little easier. Does that surprise you? That I must find a way to make life easier? I, Senior Computer Twistle, Senior Member of the All-When Council. Maybe that's why I smoke. Ever think of that? I have to have a reason, you know. Eternity is essentially an unsmoking society, and most of time is, too. I've thought of that often. I sometimes think it's a rebellion against eternity. Something to take the place of a greater rebellion that failed. No, it's all right. A tear or two won't hurt me. And it isn't pretense, believe me. It's just that I haven't thought about this for a long time. It isn't pleasant. It involved a woman, of course, as your affair did. That's not coincidence. It's almost inevitable, if you stop to think of it. an eternal who must sell the normal satisfactions of family life for a handful of perforations on foil, is ripe for infection. That's one of the reasons Eternity must take the precautions it does, and apparently that's also why Eternals are so ingenious in evading the precautions once in a while. I remember my woman. It's foolish of me to do so, perhaps. I can't remember anything else about that physio time. My old colleagues are only names in the record books. The changes I supervised, all but one, are only items in the computerplex memory pools. I remember her, though, very well. Perhaps you can understand that. I had had a long-standing request for a liaison in the books, and after I achieved status as a junior computer, she was assigned to me. She was a girl of this very century, the 575th. I didn't see her until after the assignment, of course. She was intelligent and kind, not beautiful or even pretty, but then, even when young, yes, I was young, never mind the myths, I was not noted for my own looks. We were well suited to one another by temperament, she and I, and if I were a timed man, I would have been proud to have her as my wife. I told her that many times. I believe it pleased her. I know it was the truth. Not all Eternals, who must take their women as and how computing permits, are that fortunate. In that particular reality, she was to die young, of course, and none of her analogues was available for liaison. At first, I took that philosophically. After all, it was her short lifetime which made it possible for her to live with me without deleteriously affecting reality. I am ashamed of that now, of the fact that I was glad she had a short time to live. Just at first, that is, just at first. I visited her as often as spatio-temporal charting allowed. I squeezed every minute out of it, giving up meals and sleep when necessary, shifting my labor load shamelessly whenever I could. Her amiability passed the heights of my expectations, and I was in love. I put it bluntly. My experience of love is very small, and understanding it through observation in time is a shaky matter. As far as my understanding went, however, I was in love. What began as the satisfaction of an emotional and physical need became a great deal more. Her imminent death stopped being a convenience and became a calamity. I life-plotted her. I didn't go to the life-plotting departments either, I did it myself. That surprises you, I imagine. It was a misdemeanor, but it was nothing compared to the crimes I committed later. Yes, I, Laban Twissel, Senior Computer Twissel. 3 separate times, a point in physio time came and passed during which some simple action of my own might have altered her personal reality. Naturally, I knew that no such personally motivated change could possibly be authorized by the Council. Still, I began to feel personally responsible for her death. That was part of my motivation later on, you see. She became pregnant. I took no action, though I should have. I had worked her life plot, modified to include her relationship with me, and I knew pregnancy to be a high probability consequence. As you may or may not know, timed women are occasionally made pregnant by Eternals despite precautions. It is not unheard of. Still, since no Eternal may have a child, such pregnancies as do occur are ended painlessly and safely. There are many methods. My life plotting had indicated she would die before delivery, so I took no precautions. She was happy in her pregnancy, and I wanted her to remain so. So I only watched and tried to smile when she told me she could feel life stirring within her. But then something happened. She gave birth prematurely. I don't wonder you look that way. I had a child, a real child of my own. You'll find no other Eternal, perhaps, who can say that. That was more than a misdemeanor. That was a serious felony, but it was still nothing. I hadn't expected it. Birth and its problems were an aspect of life with which I had had little experience. I went back to the life plot in panic and found the living child in an alternate solution to a low-probability forklift I had overlooked. A professional life plotter would not have overlooked it, and I had done wrong to trust my own abilities that far. But what could I do now? I couldn't kill the child. The mother had 2 weeks to live. Let the child live with her till then, I thought. 2 weeks of happiness is not an exorbitant gift to ask. The mother died as foreseen, and in the manner foreseen. I sat in her room, for all the time permitted by the spatio-temporal chart, aching with a sorrow all the keener for my having waited for death in full knowledge for over a year. In my arms I held my son and hers. Yes, I let it live. Why do you cry out so? Are you going to condemn me? You cannot know what it means to hold a little atom of your own life in your arms. I may have a computerplex for nerves and spatio-temporal charts for a bloodstream, but I do know. I let it live. I committed that crime too. I put it in the charge of an appropriate organization and returned when I could, in strict temporal sequence, held even with physio-time, to make necessary payments and to watch the boy grow. 2 years went by that way. Periodically, I checked the boy's life plot. I was used to breaking that particular rule by now, and was pleased to find that there were no signs of deleterious effects on the then-current reality at probability levels over 0.0001. The boy learned to walk and mispronounced a few words. He was not taught to call me Daddy. Whatever speculations the timed people of the child care institution might have made concerning me, I don't know. They took their money and said nothing. Then, when the 2 years had passed, the necessities of a change that included the 575th at one wing was brought up before the All-When Council. I, having been lately promoted to assistant computer, was placed in charge. It was the first change ever left to my sole supervision. I was proud, of course, but also apprehensive. My son was an intruder in the reality. He could scarcely be expected to have analogues. Thought of his passage into non-existence saddened me. I worked the change, and I flatter myself, even yet, that I did a flawless job. My first one. But I succumbed to a temptation. I succumbed to it all the more easily because it was becoming an old story now for me. I was a hardened criminal, a habitué of crime. I worked out a new life plot for my son under the new reality, certain of what I would find. But then, for 24 hours without eating or sleeping, I sat in my office, striving with the completed life plot, tearing at it in a despairing effort to find an error. There was no error. The next day, holding back my solution to the change, I worked out a spatio-temporal chart using rough methods of approximation. After all, the reality was not to last long, and entered time at a point more than 30 years upwind from the birth of my child. He was 34 years old as I myself. I introduced myself as a distant relation, making use of my knowledge of his mother's family to do so. He had no knowledge of his father, no memory of my visits to him in his infancy. He was an aeronautical engineer. The 575th was expert in half a dozen varieties of air travel, as it still is in the current reality, and my son was a happy and successful member of his society. He was married to an ardently enamored girl, but would have no children. Nor would the girl have married at all in the reality in which my son had not existed. I had known that from the beginning. I had known there would be no deleterious effects on reality. Otherwise, I might not have found it in my heart to let the boy live. I am not completely abandoned. I spent the day with my son. I spoke to him formally, smiled politely, took my leave coolly when the spatio-temporal chart dictated. But underneath all that, I watched and absorbed every action, filling myself with him, and trying to live one day at least out of a reality that the next day, by physio-time, would no longer have existed. How I longed to visit my wife one last time, too, during that portion of time in which she lived, but I had used every second that had been available to me. I dared not even enter time to see her, unseen. I returned to eternity and spent one last horrible night wrestling futilely against what must be. The next morning I handed in my computations together with my recommendations for change.
Twistle's voice had lowered to a whisper, and now it stopped. He sat there with his shoulders bent, his eyes fixed on the floor between his knees, and his fingers twisting slowly into and out of a knotted clasp. Harlan, waiting vainly for another sentence out of the old man, cleared his throat. He found himself pitying the man, pitying him despite the many crimes he had committed. He said, "And that's all?"
Twistle whispered, "No. The worst. An analogue of my son did exist. In the new reality, he existed as a paraplegic from the age of 4. 42 years in bed, under circumstances that barred me from arranging to have the nerve-regenerating techniques of the 900s applied to his case, or even for arranging to have his life ended painlessly. That new reality still exists. My son is still out there in the appropriate portion of the century. I did that to him. It was my mind and my computerplex that discovered this new life for him, and my word that ordered the change. I had committed a number of crimes for his sake and for his mother's, but that one last deed, though strictly in accordance with my oath as an eternal, has always seemed to me to be my great crime. The crime."
There was nothing to say, and Harlan said nothing. Twistle said,
"But you see now why I understand your case, why I will be willing to let you have your girl. It would not harm eternity, and, in a way, it would be expiation for my crime."
And Harlan believed. All in one change of mind, he believed. Harlan sank to his knees and lifted his clenched fists to his temples. He bent his head and rocked slowly as savage despair beat through him. He had thrown eternity away and lost Noyes when, except for his Samson smash, he might have saved one and kept the other.